You've heard of Bigfoot, the Yeti, Mothman, the Jersey Devil. Every region has a mysterious cryptid that marauds and haunts the desolate wastelands, forests, and swamplands, and Pennsylvania is no exception. What is something of an exception is that the storied Pennsylvania monster is not the requisite red-eyed, winged, hulking, hairy haunt of nightmares. No, the squonk is something else entirely. Welcome to Strange and Unexplained with me, Daisy Egan. I love a good cry. Crying is something we all do, especially when times are hard, or movies are sad, or hormones are high, or elections happen, or we're awake. Hell, I've cried myself to sleep a few times in this life, but I've always woken up the next day, my body more or less intact, my tears dried on my pillow. The subject of today's story is not so lucky. To begin, I must introduce us all to the unsung hero of this tale, the lumberjack. Now you know me, stranger, normally I would not venerate a profession that so hastily aided the deforestation of this land, but since the introduction of lumberjack influencers like Thor Bradley and Nicole Conan, I'm inclined to be a little more welcoming to our axe-wielding siblings. Those two could split my log anytime, if you know what I mean. Where was I? Oh right, lumberjacks. Turns out that aside from being hot and wearing high heels, suspenders, and a bra, lumberjacks have historically been an invaluable resource when it comes to identifying elusive and mysterious creatures who make the ever-diminishing forests their home. Without lumberjacks, we might never have heard of the poor, sad, weepy squonk. The first mention of the Pennsylvania cryptid, the squonk, is widely accepted to be in the 1910 collection of folkloric sketches and stories, Fearsome Creatures of the Lumberwoods, with a Few Desert and Mountain Beasts. The book was written and illustrated by conservationist William Thomas Cox, who wasn't from Pennsylvania at all, but was a forester for the U.S. Forest Service, and was appointed the first state and commissioner of conservation for Minnesota. Cox also organized the State Forest Protection System, which was enacted in 1911. Cox was a busy guy and passionate about forest conservation because while he was heading up new government agencies and preserving the safety of national forests, he was also an avid writer. In addition to penning Fearsome Creatures, Cox also wrote other works about forestry, nature, and conservation. He contributed a recurring column in the magazine The Farmer, and many of his writings were later anthologized in other publications. He is, despite his many accomplishments, definitely best known for Fearsome Creatures of the Lumberwoods, which happens to be a chief literary resource on what Wikipedia categorizes as Fearsome Critters of North American Folklore. And truly, the book is something else. Full of imaginative and detailed illustrations and vibrant descriptions, it catalogs the various strange creatures supposedly sighted by lumberjacks and woodsmen during their work in the deep woods and wilderness of the United States. The squonk is just one of the many wild wonders found in the book's pages. Among the other critters described are the North Idahoan Wapaloosie, which has the toes of a woodpecker and is the size of a sausage dog, and who reminds me, at least from one of the drawings I saw of it, of those videos of chihuahuas wearing winter boots for the first time. I imagine this marsupial-ish, ferret-like creature with bird feet would just have a lot of trouble walking. Then there's the Midwestern Hodag, which looks like if Jim Henson designed a Pokemon, and is not to be confused with the Midwestern Hobag, which is a bitchy girl named Linda I met in Chicago once. And the Whirling Wimpus from Tennessee, which appears to be a gorilla-esque creature that spins around like a Tasmanian devil and is described in the text as bloodthirsty. I have literally never heard of one single creature listed in this book, and I guess that makes a certain kind of sense since I admit that I am not totally up on my obscure North American wildlife, nor my early 20th century colloquial folklore. Silly me. But is this book just a glossary of magical beasts that exist only in the minds of imaginative outdoorsmen? Or is it a catalog of the real sightings of those familiar with the deep wilderness? Are these creatures, is the squonk, elusive but very real? Cox informs us in his book that the squonk is a very rare creature to happen upon. He acknowledges that, quote, few people outside of Pennsylvania have ever heard of the quaint beast, end quote. And although sightings of the elusive squonk are rarer even than Trump off a golf course, Cox managed to include a drawing of the animal, which is, admittedly, a little hard to describe. It looks like something out of a Lewis Carroll story, a cross between a toad and a pig, maybe? Subsequent drawings of the squonk in popular culture, including apparently on Squonk Talk, which is really just an episode of the Haunted City podcast's TikTok page, have it looking at times more like a toad, at others a pig, and at others a hideous Shar Pei. There's one picture that has him almost looking like an elephant crossed with Ludo from Labyrinth. The one thing everyone can agree on, however, is the creature's overall mood. Cox tells us of the squonk's species taxonomy, lacrima corpus dissolvens, made up of the Latin words for tear, body, and dissolve, likely referring to the squonk's ability to literally dissolve into a puddle of tears. And he talks about the animal's retiring disposition, saying that it typically only travels around at twilight or dusk, making it hard to glimpse. He describes the squonk as having a pitiable appearance, saying, quote, because of its misfitting skin, which is covered with warts and moles, it is always unhappy. In fact, it is said by people who are best able to judge to be the most morbid of beasts. Hunters who are good at tracking are able to follow a squonk by its tear-stained trail, for the animal weeps constantly. When cornered and escape seems impossible, or when surprised and frightened, it may even dissolve itself in tears. End quote. Girl, same. Although, to be fair, we can't really know why the thing is crying, can we? We don't know that it thinks of itself as ugly. Maybe it's crying because we think it's ugly. Cox goes on to recommend that if anyone wants to go hunting for squonks, they should do so on frosty moonlit nights because the cold freezes their tears and they don't move around as much. He says also that squonks are most often found under the boughs of dark hemlock trees, but he doesn't offer much in the way of squonk sightings or evidence. There is one story he shares as a sort of corroborating account about a man named J.P. Wentling who allegedly made the rare capture of a squonk. Quote, Mr. J.P. Wentling, formerly of Pennsylvania, but now at St. Anthony Park, Minnesota, had a disappointing experience with a squonk near Mont Alto. He made a clever capture by mimicking the squonk and inducing it to hop into a sack in which he was carrying it home, when suddenly the burden lightened and the weeping ceased. Wentling unslung the sack and looked in. There was nothing but tears and bubbles. End quote. One wonders how he induced it to climb into the sack. Plenty of kids used to mimic me, and I was never induced to voluntarily climb into a locker. No, they had to chase me down and stuff me in the locker. Also, to be fair, I would cry too if someone came into my house and tried to capture me in a sack. I really feel for this little guy. So to recap, the squonk is a homely, lumpy creature that hides out under hemlock trees in the woods, and if you catch it like old JP did, it will cry itself out of existence, leaving only bubbles for you to show to your curious cryptid-seeking mates. I honestly can't think of anything more goth. It's like Robert Smith's Patronus. But is it crying itself to death? Is it dissolving into a pile of bubbles? Or is it somehow vanishing, only to reappear somewhere else less capture-y? This capture by J.P. Wentling is the only squonk sighting in Cox's book, or honestly anywhere. In all of the field guides, stories, and songs that mention the squonk, there is not one other detailed account of an actual squonk sighting. There are mentions of glimpses of the squonk, but none contain real detail or are so vividly described. So far, the tale of the squonk doesn't strike me as the most convincing. But what if the squonk was never meant to be thought of as real? Maybe Cox had other motivations for writing his book than to prove the existence of elusive cryptids. Cox, as a forester, knew lumberjack. Lumberjacks in the early 1900s dwelled in a subculture all their own. They were incredibly strong, nearly feral men who felled trees using hand tools and had oxen drag them to the river. A piece in the journal American Sociological Review called Taming the Lumberjack from 1944 describes the profession as, quote, difficult, dangerous, intermittent, low-paying, and involved living in primitive conditions. However, the men built a traditional culture that celebrated strength, masculinity, confrontation with danger, and resistance to modernization, end quote. Sounds very manosphere-y, but out in nature with old-timey tools and a refreshing lack of Twitter and Joe Rogan. Fun fact, sometimes lumberjacks of this era were known by other regional names. In the case of Pennsylvania, woodhick was the preferred term. So when you call someone a hick, consider that you may be paying them a manly compliment. Whatever they called themselves, the deep woods tree cutters of the time were a well-established group of fearless wild men who lived and thrived in nature and seemed as much a part of the natural settings in which they could be found as the trees they felled or the creatures they described seeing. Lumberjacks made their living shouting timber and provided the materials for urban development, but their loyalties were definitely to the wilderness. Around the time that Cox wrote about the squonk, the Industrial Revolution was in full swing, and there was a substantial increase in logging. Is it any wonder, then, that this was purportedly when an uptick of squonk sightings and sightings of other fearsome creatures described by Cox occurred? As logging increased, the forests decreased. Cox and other conservationists worried that the forests would be lost to industry and the existence of lumberjacks would become obsolete. If the forests and the lumberjacks disappeared, so too would their culture. The squonk and the many creatures mythologized by lumberjacks were recorded in Cox's book to preserve that endangered culture and its folklore. It follows, then, that creatures such as the squonk described in the book might serve a different purpose than just a claim to existence. The sad-eyed, ungainly squonk might just as easily be viewed as a metaphor for what was, in Cox's eyes, happening to the woodlands and his feelings about it. The introduction of fearsome creatures shows the book as a labor of love about the disappearance of an America Cox was deeply passionate about. Quote, every lumber region has its lore. Thrilling tales of adventure are told in camp wherever the logger has entered the wilderness. The lumberjack is an imaginative being, and a story loses none of its interest as it is carried and repeated from one camp to another. Stories which I know to have originated on the Penobscot and the Kennebec are told somewhat strengthened and improved in the Redwood camps of Humboldt Bay. Yarns originating among the river drivers of the Ottawa, the St. Croix, and the Upper Mississippi are respun to groups of listening loggers on Vancouver Island. But every lumber district has its own peculiar tales. Some have their songs, also, and nearly all have mysterious stories or vague rumors of dreadful beasts with which to regale newcomers and frighten people unfamiliar with the woods. Much has been written concerning the lumberjack and his life. Some of his songs, also, rough, but full of the sentiment of his exciting vocation, have been commemorated, but, so far as I know, very few of the strange creatures in his imagination have ever been described by the naturalist or sketched by the artist. The lumber regions are contracting. Stretches of forest that once seemed boundless are all but gone, and many a stream is quiet that once ran full of logs and echoed to the song of the river driver. Some say that the old type of logger himself is becoming extinct. It is my purpose in this little book to preserve at least a description and sketch of some of the interesting animals which he has originated. End quote. But if the squonk was merely an expedient means to an end in Fearsome Creatures of the Lumberwoods, if Cox made up the legend to help tell the story of the disappearing landscape he so loved, then that probably should have been the end of the squonk. And it does seem that the book is filled with tales of strange and unusual critters that have scarcely been heard of since. But the squonk is different. The saggy, sad, and warty creature did not see its folkloric end there. Years later, in 1938, the squonk returned to cry all over the place again when fellow forester Henry Tryon published a similarly titled book to Cox's, just called Fearsome Critters. In his book, it's clear that the squonk didn't get cuter with age, but remained, quote, the homeliest animal in the world, end quote, according to Tryon, who went on to describe the squonk like this, quote, a most retiring, bashful, crepuscular animal garbed in a loose, warty, singularly ill-fitting skin. The squonk is always unhappy, even morbid. He is given to constant weeping over his really upsetting appearance and can sometimes be tracked by his tear-stained trail, end quote. I don't know if Tryon sighted Cox or if he passed this off as his own, but the description is very similar to Cox's. He also agreed with, or plagiarized, Cox's claim that moonlit nights are the best time to hunt squonk. This was the case, he said, because squonks tend not to move around much at night out of fear that they may catch a glimpse of themselves in a moonlit puddle. Again, girl, same. Tryon's book expands on Cox's conservationist perspective, explaining that the squonk's reclusiveness was the result of a diminishing habitat. According to Tryon, the squonk formerly lived in high plains and swamps before industry and development encroaching on wild spaces caused the squonk to retreat mainly to the hemlock groves of Pennsylvania. Some sources describe the squonk as existing chiefly in the Poconos, and who can blame it? I remember the commercials on TV when I was a kid inviting me to the Poconos Mount Airy Lodge to play all day and dance into the night. All I had to bring, the commercial assured me, was my love of everything, which would be impossible for someone like me who despises most things. Tryon's book tells us, by way of bolstering his claims of the squonk's presence in the hemlock groves, that a person wandering there could hear a squonk crying, again, presumably because they are sad about their looks, and that, quote, the sound is a low note of pleading, somewhat resembling the call of a cross-feathered snee, end quote. More questions than answers, am I right? I imagine the sound to be something between Fran Drescher and a cow. So a snee is apparently some sort of frosty cryptid bird about which there is little other information to be found, except for this entry from Creatures of Myth Fandom Wiki. Quote, this frostbitten, feathered fowl flutters and flourishes on fashionably frigid and frozen furrows, for it is inclined to the inclement and inhospitable iciness in its immensity. The nondescript nests in natural nooks nearing the nadir of the negatives and is native to the northwest of nowhere, and nearly as is known, is never noticed by nobody. Naturally, the nudnik is in need of a knoll nearly as non-symmetrical as knowable. After all, this asymmetric avian animal always is aware of any level land lying lengthwise in a linear layout. Unfortunately, unless it is unbalanced underneath, it is unable to be upright, as unluckily its unequal extremities eventually end it edgewise. Effectively, the entity is exceedingly exhausted and entirely exposed in this event, end quote. Which doesn't really tell us much of anything except to confirm what every writing teacher ever has cautioned, which is that one should really only ever use alliterations exceedingly sparingly, if at all. For some reason, the image that popped up when I Googled the cross-feathered snee was of a person with skeleton face makeup wearing some kind of bishop's hat. Further investigation would have required far too much more time than I have. And so the cross-feathered snee remains even more elusive than the squonk, which is sweeping the nation.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
Anyway, Tryon continues to go deeper into the squonk's history and physiology, claiming it did not originally have webbed feet, but eventually developed webbing on the left foot because that was the foot that got submerged in water. I really don't understand this assertion. Not that the rest of what the squonk has going on is so easy to grasp, but the left foot thing seems so arbitrary. So all squonks got only their left feet wet for so long that they experienced a macroevolution and developed a formerly absent physical trait to compensate? If Darwin were alive, this might give him an aneurysm. Of course, if Darwin were alive and found a squonk, he would have eaten it. Regardless, I think it might be best to treat the evolutionary science of the squonk like John Travolta's hairline, and not look too closely. So because of this odd one-sided trait, Tryon explained that should a squonk find itself submerged in water, it would only be able to swim in circles and could not possibly return to shore. He also claims that the lakes where squonks once swam, what lakes he is referring to, I do not know, were dredged and that fossils discovered there showed thousands of squonks perished in this manner. There is, stranger, zero information anywhere else that we could find about squonk fossils or some mass squonk extinction. I am shocked. Regardless of the questionable science and non-existent evidence in Tryon's book, the squonk kept on persisting and showing up in sundry places over the years. Like in Cox and Tryon's books, the descriptions of the squonk don't change much. Its consensus seems to generally be that they have saggy, warty skin, moles, webbed feet, and are always crying because of how ugly they think they are. Most descriptions of the squonk also agree that the squonk is a very stupid animal, but in an interesting contradiction, a 2023 piece about the squonk on PennLive.com mentions how acutely aware the squonk is of how ugly it is, highlighting again how its misery stems from its hatred of its own appearance. Quote, "For all its alleged dullness, the squonk appears to be painfully aware of just how repulsive it is. In fact, it's so painfully aware of its looks that Cox claims the poor thing is given to constant weeping over his really upsetting appearance and can sometimes be tracked by his tear-stained trail," end quote. So doesn't that sort of negate the idea of being woefully stupid? I mean, the idea that it knows it's fugly tells us it has self-awareness, which hints at a more developed consciousness, and the idea that it would cry over its appearance tells us that it has the cognitive complexity necessary to experience regret and self-loathing, and to express it as emotion. Though, Lord knows, there are plenty of pretty hideous people, at least on the inside, who don't seem too terribly self-aware. To be fair, I'm not sure I'd categorize them as terribly cognitively complex, though. Another wild claim about the squonk that definitely elevates it above your run-of-the-mill dopey cryptid is that the squonk supposedly reproduces through binary fission, meaning it splits itself in half to reproduce. What in the holy slime mold are we talking about here? What even is a squonk? I know, it's Pennsylvania's saddest mythical creature, but like, is it a mammal? It seems to possess some mammalian traits, like crying real hot, salty tears of pain and despair, but asexual binary fission really isn't very mammalian of it. The only creatures on Earth that reproduce that way are bacteria, amoebas, and other tiny, shapeless shit like that. Not giant, sad, forest-dwelling pig toads. Also, I have yet to read anything about multiple squonks or squonk families. What would a group of squonks be called anyway? A dysphoria of squonks? A muffin top of squonks? Anyway, I'm no biologist, but the argument so far for the real existence of the squonk is not great. Binary fission probably seemed a lot more plausible in 1900 when there was no internet or biology class in middle school. Add to that, some of the same articles that talk about this binary fission nonsense also recommend that to get proof that squonks exist, one should stick to taking pictures or video rather than try to capture a squonk due to their tendency to kill themselves by dissolving into a puddle of tears when caught. So, take the oh-so-scientific Loch Ness approach. Got it. I'll run right down to the Poconos Hemlock Groves with my Polaroid and see what kind of pics I can snap. For posterity and science. But, as implausible as it is, there is just something about the squonk. Maybe the fact that it is sadness personified? Cryptidified? Or maybe its indivisible connection to man's war on the environment? Maybe the squonk is crying all the time over the climate change it knew would be triggered by the Industrial Revolution that brought it to light, and not its own skin condition. Whatever the case, the squonk continues to find a place in our evolving culture. The 1926 book Paul Bunyan and His Great Blue Ox by Wallace Wadsworth mentions the squonk in its tall tales, which is unsurprising given the squonk's connection to lumberjacks, and Bunyan being the biggest, larger-than-life lumberjack of them all, with an even bigger ox. An article on WikiHow about the squonk says of the passage, quote, "Even the great American legend Paul Bunyan had such a run-in with a squonk. In Paul Bunyan and His Great Blue Ox, Paul and his men are stalled in cutting timber when one hears a queer wailing some distance away. The more the man mimics the wailing, the closer the strange sound gets until eventually he's able to apprehend an unsuspecting squonk in a bag. So rarely did it ever get near men that the logger who had caught the squonk was greatly elated and called his friends to the bunkhouse to see the queer creature when he put it on view," reads Paul Bunyan. Alas, the logger's elation was only momentary, as the squonk did what it does best and dissolved in its distress into nothing but some salt water and bubbles, end quote. So there is another account of the fictional lumberjack catching the squonk. I stand corrected. The squonk appears in other literature as well. Famed Argentine writer Jorge Luis Borges mentions the squonk in his 1960s-era Book of Imaginary Beings. Unfortunately, my review of the entry revealed that Borges merely quotes William Thomas Cox's book, and that the squonk is one of the only creatures he does not write about in his own words. The band Genesis, post-Peter Gabriel, wrote a song about the squonk in the late 1970s. Phil Collins names it among his favorite Genesis songs and calls it their Zeppelin song, presumably because it rocks? And it's about mythological shit? Or is it? There is much discussion on the internet about this song by fans and curious types, some of whom claim to have been squonk hunting. Steely Dan also mentions the squonk in the 1970s song Any Major Dude Will Tell You, with the lyric, quote, "Have you ever seen a squonk's tears? Well, look at mine," end quote. Have you ever seen a squonk's tears? Well, look at mine. I guess the 60s and 70s were the squonk's main character era. It makes sense. People were into esoteric spiritual ideas and drugs that led them to have open minds about things that might otherwise seem unlikely. Awareness of looming man-made environmental catastrophe and climate change was growing. Est, hair, a broad cultural appreciation of fantasy, the more mainstream acceptance of therapy, emotional awareness, and men crying all seem right in line with the squonk's gestalt, don't they? And in my favorite example of a pop culture reference to the squonk is the annual festival held in August in Jonestown, Pennsylvania, called, you guessed it, Squonkapalooza. The festival website states that it exists, quote, to celebrate and show love to the squonk in hopes of helping it feel better, end quote. I can think of worse reasons to party. About you, stranger, but I've come to kind of adore this ugly little dude. I like to imagine myself encountering one in the woods. Why I would be in the woods, I don't know, but just go with me here. And after getting over the initial shock and its unusual appearance, perhaps sitting down and being still long enough to get it to trust me so that maybe I could pet its little body and maybe give it some comfort and say, listen, I know what it's like to feel outcast and alone. In college once, some guy met me for 2 minutes and told a mutual friend that he hated girls like me. I have no idea what I possibly could have divulged in those 2 minutes, during which no doubt he was the one doing all the talking, that would have made him draw such a harsh conclusion of me. But it took me many years to understand that I was not the problem in the scenario. He was. "You're not the problem, my warty little friend. We humans are. Who's to even say if you cry when humans aren't around? Maybe you're actually the happiest of fellas, and it's just the presence of us tree-cutting, sack-carrying humans that reduces you to tears. I get you, buddy. I get you." The squonk's origins, while somewhat murky, are certainly tied to a mindset that valued nature and the unique culture of those who worked in and loved the natural world. It seems fitting, then, that the squonk should evolve in the modern age to become, as an article from Penn Live calls it, an, quote, "icon of the awkward, isolated, and alone," end quote. And stranger, what are human beings if not all those things at one time or another in our lives? I think the strangest and most unexplained thing is not the questionable existence of a warty, forest-dwelling, circle-swimming, weepy toad monster, but rather the way we evolve and come to understand ourselves. When we could just plop down in the shadows and cry about what monsters we can be, instead we continue to grow as a species, eventually emerging from difficult periods in our history with new wisdom and always marching towards an uncertain but hopeful future, in which we are maybe a little less isolated and alone, but probably still pretty awkward. And if not, we can just go ahead and cry ourselves right out of existence. Next time on Strange and Unexplained, we all know the story of Jack the Ripper, the man who terrorized the working women of Whitechapel, London. But what about his victims? To this day, it's hard to know how many there were. Strange and Unexplained is a production of Three Goose Entertainment with help from Grab Bag Collab. This episode was written by Eve Kerrigan and me, Daisy Egan, with research by the Strange Research Squad. Sound design and engineering by Jeff Devine. Music by Epidemic and Blue Dot Sessions. If you have an idea for an episode, head to our website, strangeandunexplainedpod.com, and fill out the contact form. I will write back. For more amazing content, join us at patreon.com/grabbagcollab, where for just $5 a month, you get all the Grab Bag exclusive shows, and for $8, you get those, plus Amber Hunt's Crimes of the Centuries and Strange and Unexplained early and ad-free. Grab Bag is an all-female and non-binary-owned profit-share network where our contributors get to keep ownership of their shows. We strive to give a platform to those who might not be able to land themselves on a bigger network. Who knows? Maybe you have a podcast idea you'd like to pitch to Grab Bag. We've got live recordings, watch parties, book clubs, and more. Why there's so much going on over at Grab Bag, you'll wonder if we missed the memo on how capitalism works. Join me on Instagram at SNUPod, Daisy Egan, and Grab Bag Collab. Or head to the Facebook page to join in the conversation. If you like the show, please visit a sponsor with our unique code, give us a quick review and 5 stars, subscribe and download, and tell a friend. Stay strange.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.